Dr. Rock's radio show. Thursday, 8 p.m. on peoplesinternetradio.com. We go to 11.
Well, good evening and a very warm welcome, one and all, to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com. Kicked off with Thin Lizzy. The boys are back in town, because on a Thursday night they are. 6 till 8, Nick Nomick. 8 till 11, Dr. Rock. And 9 till the wee small hours, PIR's very own man with a microscope, Freeman Jack. I suspect that you could search far and wide and not find entertainment and information like that anywhere else. Talking of which, thanks to Nick Nomick for the previous show, of course, and he's just enjoying a chilled glass of Paraffino in the shade of the pavilion, and will be joining us again, hopefully, for a chat around 10 o'clock, when we will hopefully find out what sort of thing it is that brought him to PIR, and of course, before that, way back, TNS. Because, you know, there's a lot of us have been hanging around here quite a long time now, and I think it's sometimes helpful for a couple of us to get together and find out, explore a little bit, if you like, what the hell it is that we think we're doing here after all of this time. And on that subject, because it's been a bit of a busy week, unfortunately I keeled over after last week's show and ended up spending 48 hours asleep and another 48 hours recovering. As a result, I may well not be sounding my usual smooth self. I think my voice certainly sounds a bit rough in here. I don't know what it sounds like to you. So that really robbed me of a fair bit of the week, not had a lot of prep time. But as it happens, I came across a Mark Stevens interview with a man called Professor Robert Diab, who is a law professor. And the question of just what the hell it is we're doing here is, I think, very nicely addressed in this sort of 40-minute or so interview. I enjoy Mark's interviewing style as much as anything else. He listens very carefully, and the law professor, he's not actually squirming under the questioning, but my goodness, he's profoundly good at kind of evading the precise direction of the question. It is quite remarkable. It's remarkable because of Mark's interviewing style. It's remarkable because of the come dancing style with which Robert Diab answers the question, but also because it addresses fundamentally what it is we are doing here, which is whether all of this stuff that's being visited upon us is actually in any sense valid at all, which is why I played Curb Crawler, really, because one way or the other, we're being curb crawled by solicitors more or less every minute of every day, people trying to solicit money and contracts and God knows what else. And it's all just rolling on absolutely remorselessly. And I think it's really grand. Well, I hope you think it is too, to hear a detailed an attempt to really get to the roots of what it is we're dealing with here. I'm sure Nick will have listened to it as well. And after about 40 minutes or so, I will I'll come back to you. In the meantime, I'll try and ease my voice with a bit more water and maybe some beer. Of course, in between Curb Crawler and The Boys Are Back in Town, we had Aretha Franklin, You Better Think What You're Doing to Me, which I quite agree with as well. So I'll give my voice another bit of a rest. I'll be back with you in 40 minutes or so, and Nick Nomick will be with us shortly thereafter. See you in a bit.
Let me get right into this. I appreciate your time. Of course, you're Robert Diab. You're an assistant professor at the law school for Thomas Rivers University in British
Thompson
Columbia.
Thompson Rivers, yeah.
Yes. Okay. The issue that I had, there's two main issues I want to get to, at least to the one. It has to do with the common legal presumption or argument that is used to justify, that government agents justify their actions by, and that is, if somebody is physically in Canada, then the Canadian laws apply, and whatever police agency or court is in the area would have jurisdiction. Now, I've not been able to discuss, you know, get any kind of evidence to support that that argument or that claim is actually true. So would you have any evidence to show that just because I or somebody else was physically in Canada, that the laws of Canada would apply and that there would be jurisdiction over us?
That's an interesting question. I mean, we don't typically seek justification for it. I mean, it doesn't it doesn't typically come up as an issue. I think that it's, as far as I understand, it seems to be a basic premise of kind of the modern liberal state, that the state has sovereignty over its territory, which means that it has jurisdiction, it has kind of the authority to apply its laws to anyone within its jurisdiction. I mean, I think that's just what I assume. I'm just trying to imagine a case in which somebody would take issue with those assumptions. And one example that comes to mind would be in tax cases. I remember being in the courts on a number of occasions where a tax matter would come up. I mean, these were not cases I was involved in myself, but I would be in the courtroom when a tax matter would come up, and an individual taxpayer would stand up and say and take issue with the idea that the court has jurisdiction over them, or whether would simply make an issue of whether the state has the jurisdiction to tax them. And so on, and those arguments did not tend to get very far. And so, so long as the person identified themselves as the taxpayer in question who hasn't paid their taxes, that was it. It would proceed from there. So, I'm not sure if that answers your question, but that's my reading of it.
Well, it's interesting. A lot of the words that you used is very common. That there, you called it an assumption, and then you said that people would make an issue of it and that those arguments would be rejected. Now, I've had a similar thing happen where I'm just asking a question of evidence like I'm doing to you right now. And bureaucrats will typically reframe my question of evidence into an argument so that they can say, I'm not going to argue with you or your argument is frivolous, when I haven't presented an argument at all. I think you're right. It is an assumption. It's a, it's a modern premise, although it probably goes back, it's probably not so modern. They've always thought that if you were in the realm, the king's laws applied and, things like that. It just doesn't really answer the question, though. It may not be something that comes up very often, because usually there are attorneys involved, and attorneys are officers of the court, and they're not going to necessarily challenge the underlying presumption or premise that they're a job and the whole system rests on. So it's people like myself that are doing it. It doesn't really answer the question, what evidence would there be, if any, that would prove that just because I was physically in Canada, that Canadian laws would apply to me?
Well, again, I mean, I think it's an axiomatic assumption of contemporary law in the Western democracy that the state has sovereignty over its territory, and that one of the kind of incidents of sovereignty is that it may or it will apply its laws to everyone within its jurisdiction, and that everyone within the jurisdiction enjoys the benefits of those laws equally. So you can interrogate those assumptions by asking, well, when did I individually, Joe Citizen or a visitor, for example, when did I accede to those assumptions? I mean, so for example, I was born in Canada, or if you were born in the United States, you might say, fine, you have this entity called the United States of America. It claims sovereignty over this territory. But I was born here, and I feel entitled to be here as anyone else, and I don't remember ever agreeing to be part of this. I think those are really important questions, and that the only answer to them is a kind of theoretical one, a notional one. And, we can turn to Rousseau, we can turn to Hobbes, and we can Locke. We can try and construct a theory as to what's happening here. I mean, is it that in a sense, I am impliedly consenting to be a part of the state on the idea that, in return for security, I get the benefit of the law and so on. And that generally speaking, if I don't like this arrangement, I'm free to leave. Is that kind of the larger argument for this? Because so long as I remain here, I have to abide by the laws. That would be my closest approximation, I think.
I think that particular approximation or that argument falls in the fact that everybody physically in Canada is forced to pay. You either pay or you go to jail. So
yeah.
The idea of implied consent, you would agree that it really isn't a implied consent, or any consent, when it's pay or go to jail.
Like you mean taxes?
Right. All support for the Canadian government is by taxation, and taxation is a political euphemism for pay or go to jail.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, you tell me. I mean, look, I mean, you're free to leave if you don't like it, but you sort of can't. You're not free to stay and opt out of it, is, I guess, your point.
Yeah, but free to leave is kind of, doesn't that sound more like you're blaming the victim and you're excusing the abhorrent behavior of the individual who's using the force?
I don't disagree, but what it comes back to is your initial question, which is a really good one. When did the state acquire the legitimacy, the authority by which it can, you know, put us in this situation where we have to choose either, you know, pay or leave, you know, or else you're going to go to jail? I mean, when did it acquire that authority? And I think the short answer is it never really did. It simply asserted that authority. This is simply how sovereignty developed, and we can attempt, you know, theoretical justifications of it, but they're notional, right? I mean, they're arguments, and maybe they don't ultimately stand up. You know, maybe you're not ultimately satisfied by the theory of implied consent. This is a live issue for Canadians because a number of Aboriginal peoples in Canada, especially in the western part of Canada, do not have treaties with the Crown. And so there was no point in time at which they agreed to cede sovereignty locally to the Crown. And the courts in Canada in the last 20 years, and especially in the last 5 or 10, have been increasingly sympathetic to the argument that, look, we never sort of came to an agreement with them, and so there's a lot of land in Canada, a lot of land in British Columbia, over which the claim to sovereignty is sort of unclear. And, you know, and without a sort of clear basis on which to say, you know, at this point in time, you gave up your claim to this land, we can't really say that they no longer have a claim. And in the summer, or a little earlier, there was a case called Chilcotin where the Supreme Court of Canada recognized their sovereignty, their claim, their right to title over a very substantial area of land in British Columbia. It's in the kind of lower middle part of the province, and so I think these developments are a recognition in part of the fact that apart from the blunt assertion of sovereignty, there is really no kind of airtight argument or justification for why the state has jurisdiction over everyone.
But when you say state, you always refer to it as it or an entity. Isn't the state just nothing really more than a DBA for people? Just the government, what we call the government, is just people, right? People like yourself.
Well, you could say that, but I mean, one of the more interesting developments of modern law from roughly, you know, the 16th century onward is the invention of the state as an entity apart from the people who run it or who populate it, and that may be a fiction, but it's a pretty important fiction, and it has a certain momentum behind it now that would be difficult to undo. You know, much of the world now organizes itself along the lines of this fiction. So, you are entirely right, I think, to attack it or to question its veracity, its legitimacy, and so on. But it's a fact, I think, that it is a major organizing, you know, concept or framework in contemporary society. And it isn't going to go away easily, if you know what I mean.
No, from what you're saying is that they just asserted it. And so what you're talking about is a group of men and women, well, at the time, mainly men, if not all men, they just asserted that they had somehow a different right than everybody else, that they could just assert that their rules apply to everybody in a certain physical area. I mean, that's what I'm getting from, I think we're on the same page there, that you just a group of men asserted that we are the government and everyone in this area will pay us or we will pay men to put them in jail. I mean, that sounds pretty accurate.
Yes, yeah, except I think that the idea of tax comes a little later. I mean, I think they assert the power and authority first for at least, you know, two or three centuries, and then they begin taxing much later in time. But yes, I think you're right.
So it still begs the question, and maybe it's just more of a clarification from you. As far as being able to prove that just because I'm in, you know, with evidence, just because I'm physically in Canada, to prove that these laws apply to me, how would... I don't, from what I'm getting from you, what you're saying, it's axiomatic. It's just a matter of opinion. It's a matter of just because we said so. Well, and it's based on, well, guys a couple hundred years ago asserted it. I mean, I had someone recently tell me it all goes back to, actually, I think it was one of your judges that said this, John Rook in the Meads case, that it all apparently goes back to William the Conqueror. I said, well, if it's, but I don't want to get too far off it. So let me just ask you, given that it's axiomatic and doesn't seem, and it's theoretical, wouldn't you agree then that you can't prove beyond a reasonable doubt that the laws apply to somebody just because they're physically in Canada?
I think you're confusing different notions. I mean, when you assert as a proposition, you know, or rather, when you ask us a question, which you did at the beginning, do the laws of Canada apply to everyone within our territorial jurisdiction? I mean, as a practical matter, they do. I mean, I'm simply saying that if you come to Canada, you will find that the laws will apply to you. They will be applied as a practical matter. It's a separate question as to whether there is a justification for their application. If you sort of stand up in court when you're pulled over for speeding, say, and say to the judge, Your Honor, prove to me that they ought to apply, they should apply, that they, you know, they deserve to apply and so forth. That's a different issue. I mean, the judge, and I agree with you, the judge will, you will stump the judge. The judge will say, well, I can't ultimately justify their application to you. That's not my job. My job is simply to apply them. I'm simply going to assume the authority to apply them. And I'm going to apply them, and if you don't like it, the sheriff is going to stand right behind you and, you know, put you in handcuffs and take you downstairs. You see what I mean?
Well, see, it's nice that you understand the practical application of this, but you got my question wrong. My question at the beginning, and it still is there any evidence to prove that just because I'm physically in Canada that your laws apply to me? And I think you're absolutely right what you're saying about the judge. You are going to stump the judge. But who we're really looking to stump is the prosecutor, because the prosecutor bears the burden of proof because he's the one that filed the complaint. So, again, the question is there any evidence to prove that just because I'm physically in Canada, the laws apply?
Well, once again, the reason I don't think that's a meaningful way of posing the question is that evidence would be tendered in a court of law where it to support a finding of fact that you want the court to make. So in other words, you want the court to find as a fact that John is guilty of speeding. You would not enter a court of law to debate the issue of whether the law applies to a certain, well, generally speaking, I mean, you might argue about whether a certain law applies to a person in a given situation, but as a general proposition, you wouldn't walk into court and say, and encounter a debate between the Crown and an accused as to whether the laws of Canada apply to someone. I mean, that would, once again, that would be axiomatic. That would not be something the Crown is called upon to prove as a matter of evidence.
Yeah, but you threw a word in there that is typical of, and I'm not saying you are, because we've been on for a while, and it's a pleasure to speak with you and explore these issues. But usually when the word debate is thrown in there, it's usually also put in with argue. And I'm not, and when someone asks a question of evidence, It's not an issue. It's not an invitation to debate. It's just the prosecution has the burden of proving. The one who makes the proponent of the argument always bears the burden of proof, and that's true even in the courts, as corrupt and as I believe, you know, Steve, that they are. But even that holds. So my asking a question: what evidence do you have to support this legal claim? Whether we're in or out of court, the claim is made all day. So whether someone's in or out of court is completely irrelevant, really, to whether or not there is evidence to support the claim. And from what I'm getting from you, and you've said it a number of times, it's not a matter of evidence. It's a matter of theory, and that you're considering it axiomatic that we're taking it as true because other people have said so. I mean, would that be an accurate characterization?
I think so, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Yeah, it's a starting point. You know, the laws apply, and the question is, you know, does this law apply to the law that you cannot speed? Does it apply in the case of this person? You know, has this person sped? That's what we want to have evidence about. But
you can't get in the door, sir. I mean, territorial jurisdiction in or out of court. The jurisdiction being a threshold issue. Whether or not somebody violated the law is completely irrelevant until you first are able to prove that the laws apply.
Right, and look, I agree with you, but what I'm trying to convey is the simple point that the question of whether the law applies to a person is not a matter on which the courts ask the Crown to establish evidence. It's not the starting point. There are a number of cases in Canada, and I'm sure there are thousands in the States, where people attempt to evade the jurisdiction of the court or the jurisdiction of the state. That's how they try to kind of start the case. And I think the courts in both countries and probably across the Western world are very clear that they simply won't entertain that kind of argument. They're always going to say, no, we start from the premise that our laws apply to everyone, and what's your answer to the claim that you've broken the law? That's the only question here.
Okay, so that begs the question. That begs the question, though, being, and we've asked this of judges, and you're right, it tends to stump them, and they call security. But the question being, do these laws apply to me because you said so, or because the prosecution's evidence proves it?
No, it's because we said so. No, it has that quality of just a mere assertion.
Because
there is something, you know, yeah, it's simply an assertion of power and authority. It isn't justified in a rational way, and it's certainly not. It's not justified by evidence. Neither argument nor evidence is made in this respect. Any call for it will go unanswered.
That's true.
You'll just be told the starting point.
That's true. However, it really makes a mess of things on cross-examination when, let's say, a tax agent for the CRA or a police officer has made that legal determination and is now on cross-examination dealing with his competency and his credibility. And 100% of the time you do that, you can get the Crown or the state prosecutor to actually impeach his own witness and say the witness isn't qualified. Now the judge is in a real bad spot. He just impeached the only witness against you that he's not qualified to give legal opinions, and yet the whole thing is based on a legal opinion that you violated the law. I'm glad that you did say it was irrational and it's because we said so, because that leads me because it's not an issue of evidence, whether you're in or out of court. It's just you have men and women asserting it. And it's nothing more than under all that paperwork is a very real gun and a threat that if you don't do as we tell you, we will go through this thing called a prosecution and we will put you in jail. So my next question is to really strike at the root more at how the immoral, irrational basis of the system, government, not just Canada, all of them, is to ask you if I was to do things like the Canadian government, the men and women who are the Canadian government, and I was to force perfect strangers to give me money, would you consider me a criminal?
Well, that's right. That would be there would be something untoward about that. By the way, I don't know that it's immoral. I wasn't seeking to comment on the morality of it, but
okay.
But this, an obvious, it's obviously part and parcel of a larger colonial tradition or an imperialist tradition, obviously. But if you're looking at, for example, the United Kingdom alone, and you go back far enough into this history, it's not about imperialism, it's just about kind of the violence with which the state is always founded. So I'm not sure where morality fits in there, but you know, it's definitely a consideration.
Is it immoral for somebody to force a stranger to give the money?
It is.
Okay.
And I agree. And there's a whole bunch of moral issues about peoples who have been disenfranchised by the creation of the state, Aboriginal peoples. There's issues with when a state erects borders and keeps people out, like immigration, similar issues with extradition when we're talking about states handing people over mm-hmm. to face the death penalty outside of the country. These are all issues that call into question the morality of sovereignty. You're entirely right to be questioning it, and you're free to question it. That's also part of the modern state too. But I would bring it back. I would bring our conversation back to the question of what's the practical effect of it. I mean, by calling into question the legitimacy of the state's claim to jurisdiction, what can you really accomplish? That's my question.
Well, ultimately, in the long run, is to get to a voluntary stateless society where the concept of government is no longer accepted by enough people, that enough people will not participate and will not comply, they won't cooperate. I can't say, or comply. So that's what we're, part of what, mainly what I'm looking to do on the show. It also has been able to, on three continents, been able to, by striking at the root and showing the prosecution or the proponent of the argument, admittedly has no evidence because we said so, has gotten a lot of tickets and assessments thrown out and continues to do so on three continents, which is great. But I want to, the issue, now you agree that if I did it as an individual, it's immoral. Now, government being just men and women, isn't it just as immoral or as immoral for them to force perfect strangers to give them money?
Well, it can be. It can be.
It can be.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yes, just in among other ways, the ways we were talking about in terms of the Aboriginal crown dispute. I think there's a great deal of moral turpitude in that relationship.
So are there examples where it would not be immoral to force a perfect stranger to give you money?
Well, I mean, in the sense that we spoke of earlier, where, you find yourself a resident of a community and the community raises, for example, like the government of that community raises taxes and you're confronted with a choice. Do I want to continue paying into this scheme or do I have to move? In that sense, you are obliged, but not necessarily forced in the same way that you are when you're robbed, right? I mean, when you're robbed, a certain violence is going to be done to you. Whereas when taxes are raised in a certain area, you are free to leave. And you're also free to oppose and to protest and to be part of the government, right? I mean, you can go to City Hall and raise a stink and, you're free to try and persuade a majority of your fellow community members that this is not a good idea. We should not have high taxes, and so on. So I don't know that the robbery analogy maps onto this perfectly.
Well, you keep saying leave. If we can establish that it's immoral for me to force a perfect stranger to give me money, how does that make it not immoral just because my victim can run away? How does that change the fundamental immoral act that I'm committing?
Well, because, I mean, with the analogy of being robbed is one in which, or at least the example is one in which you have no, like you and the robber have no connection, no relationship. Whereas when I'm a member of a community that's taxing me, the taxing authority isn't this absolute other, right? It's not this foreign entity, this enemy, right? It's me, it's my family, it's my It's my community, right? It's my neighbor. It's the collection of neighbors.
I would say that that's wrong, because we've already come to agreement that the issue of implied consent is wrong, because everyone is forced to pay. I'm sure you would agree that the relation.
Right. I mean, on that reading, once again, the state or the government is this illegitimate entity that is totally other than all the citizens that make up the state. I don't know, but I'm not sure I agree with that. I think there's other ways of reading what the state is or what the government is. Maybe a better analogy for it is it's the community deciding how it's going to govern itself, if that makes sense.
It doesn't make sense because we know that everybody is forced to pay, and just because someone like yourself can get and be a part of the organization is really no different than in ancient Israel, where the local Jews were used as tax collectors for the Romans. Yeah, they were collecting the taxes, but you know it was still a grossly immoral, destructive, violent organization known as the Roman government. So it really, I don't think it goes against the evidence to say that the people called government who are acting as government are actually agents of the people in doing what they want, because everyone is forced to pay. You either pay or you go to jail, or you're told, if you don't like the fact that I am forcing you to pay, you can always leave. Which of course is another fallacy, because you can't just leave. You need permission to leave. You would never be able to cross without permission from the Canadian government into the United States government. It's an old fallacy that really crops up to justify what I think we're in agreement with, in that it is immoral to force strangers to pay you, even if you live in the same community.
Is it theoretically legally possible in the United States to pass a constitutional amendment that says tomorrow, could this not happen in theory, a majority of the United, like whatever the amending formula is for the U.S. Constitution, but the point is it's going to take a very strong majority. But let's just say, hypothetically, 98% of the United States, of the population in the United States, decides tomorrow that we want to amend the Constitution to make taxation, to abolish taxation of any kind, okay? Can they do that? Yes, they can. That is a theoretical possibility, okay? So what that means is that taxation is not the result of a small minority of people in the United States, the government, placing an obligation on the rest of the people. Because the people collectively have this power to change the rules, to make up the rules as they go along, in theory, the rules as they stand are the collective expression of the will of the people. Is that not so?
No, I disagree, because everybody, like the implied consent argument, the facts are, and I don't think we can reasonably dispute these facts, that everybody pays, or that you go, the threat is you pay or you go to jail. It's in the CRA's own paperwork. That's right.
That's the law as we have it now, right? But is this law being imposed by this absolute other we call the government, this Martian entity, that's coming along and saying to us strangers, the good citizens, you must pay or you will suffer violent consequences? Or is it really that in theory, but also quite literally, notionally, we can tomorrow decide collectively whatever we want? We could tomorrow decide constitutionally, we could amend the U.S. Constitution to say tomorrow the government will no longer resign, you know, it'll no longer be Congress in Washington. It will be some sort of, it will be something that meets once every 5 years. It'll have no taxing authority. I mean, it can be whatever it wants, right? I mean, is there not this freedom in the modern democracy?
Well, yes, you could do that. I think the more important thing that I look at is that once enough people don't buy into, and this will be another question for you, the double standard that is okay to lie, steal, kill, and cheat people just because you call yourself a government. And once people
– Wait, let me finish. We're talking about – depression of the majority but against it all, the minority.
It all comes from that because the people accept a double standard that it is okay to force other people to give the money if you call yourself a government. All the other abuse stems directly from that. And so the people, when enough people, which is why I do this show, not to go through the political process, but to get enough people to understand that these people who are called government are only government because they said so. They only have authority because they say so. They only have all these things because they say so. They're no more legitimate than a mafia or La Cosa Nostra.
Now you're making a different point. So now your point is that the government doesn't have a true mandate is I guess the point you're now making. So it's a different point from the one we were chatting about just a minute ago. So, can't you disprove that or address that by showing, look, a majority of American citizens, like, I don't know, a significant majority, like, if 70% of the voting public in the United States voted for the government, does that not address your concern?
No, because the only concern that is important is that the foundation forcing other people to pay you is wrong. It's always wrong. And that's why I asked you, can there be an exception to that? And you didn't answer it directly. You initially said it can be.
Right, okay. So now this is a different argument still. So in other words, if in a community of 20 people, 15 of them decide that everybody should pay tax. What you're suggesting is that it's illegitimate if one of the remaining five who didn't think taxation was a good idea, if they have to pay tax against their will. Is there not something untoward about that?
No, I think you're mischaracterizing it. I think what you're asking, with the more accurate way to put that, is we all agree that it is immoral and wrong to force somebody to give you money. What you're trying to say is if 15 people get together, they can violate that moral law because they have numbers. And I disagree with that completely, because that's the same as saying, well, we've got 15, you only got 3, and we're saying rape is moral. And so I think what you're saying is that it's okay to force other people to give you money if you have a majority who agree to disregard the moral code of do no harm, or that it's wrong to, you know, force people to pay.
Well, I would say that you're skipping a step, and the first step that we can't overlook is that those 20 people began by saying, let's have a government. Like, let's not just be 20 people who happen to be living in a certain area. Let's have a government, and let's choose our own government. Let's not be governed by someone outside. Let's not have a king. Let's not have sort of one family that passes government down within itself. Let's elect every certain on a term basis. Let's choose among ourselves a leader. So one of the 20 people or a group of them is made the government. And that government is, in theory, acting on behalf of all 20. And that government decides we're going to have taxation and may even put to a referendum, what do you think, all 20, should we have? Should we have taxation? So 15 of them agree we should have taxation. So 5 disagreed. So 5 are now in a conundrum. They can leave the community, or if they remain, the reason that they're going to be paying tax is not because they want to, yes, in a sense they're being forced to, but because they want to be a part of that community and they want to abide by the democratic system that's been chosen by that community as a way to govern itself. Now, is that not a fair way of describing what's going on in your local area?
No, it's not fair at all. There's no evidence that it's not true historically for the United States. It's certainly not true for the UK or Canada. You're talking about something that has absolutely never happened, where an entire community agreed to force themselves to pay each other. In on the other side of it, though, if that's not what you're saying, community.
Back up a bit. But no, I mean, think about the foundation of the United States, okay, as a sovereign nation. The tax story is central to it, right? I mean, it was being overtaxed by Britain. It didn't like that idea, and so it revolted, and it said, we're going to be a separate country. we're going to be a country consisting of these states.
That's the narrative, sir.
Did that not happen?
No, that's the narrative, but what actually drove the revolution was Western expansion. George had cut the cut Western expansion. So if you look at
we're not there yet. How did we create our state, though?
But what if you're looking at the American example, you're talking about people who, just like you said in Canada, declared it. And they said anybody who's not fighting for us, they passed their own navigation acts, and they started confiscating property and putting people like the Quakers and all the pacifists in jail and confiscating all their stuff. The American government is certainly not a beacon of moral authority, and it would really not be a good road to go down if you want to discuss a moral issue, you know, moral line with government, because the United States government historically knew that was a war of Western expansion. It was not, that was the narrative that they gave to get people to, you know, hey, we got no taxation without reparations. It was Western expansion. So the U.S. government, especially after what they did after 1778 or 1777, is not an example historically. They committed genocide against the American Indians. They plotted to completely destroy them, and that's why they almost completely annihilated their food supply of the buffalo. So it really is getting away, I think, from the issue, because the other thing that I think you may have been saying, though, is that you're talking about 20 people agreeing to do something, and if they are agreeing to that, then they're not forcing each other to do something, and you're getting away from the whole moral issue or the facts of why government is immoral in the first place, and that is because everyone is forced to pay. There's the threat behind it. You're giving an example where there is no threat and not necessarily any coercion and jail time. And so I don't think that's an accurate analogy.
But, I mean, I think you've got to distinguish between the formation of a government and its decision to tax people. They don't necessarily go together. I think really the issue is when people disagree with being taxed or don't want to be taxed, whether that's one issue and the question of their relationship to the government is, you know, ought to be seen as a second issue. So I'm not sure. I mean, I think we're apart on this reading, but I do think it's worth distinguishing those two issues.
I understand that. It still comes down to a ruling class where you have, you know, someone telling a stranger, do this or you'll be punished. So even if you don't take taxation into the equation when you're talking about government, you know, just because it's just men and women, and they are forcing you to pay them. And so if we take that out, you're still having one person threatening another person that they should or should not do something. And unless that is, hey, you shouldn't aggress against me, unless the rule is do no harm, otherwise if you attack me, I will do what I need to do to defend myself. But that's not what government is talking. What they're talking about, you do as I say, or I will punish you severely. And I got these jails over here to do that. And so that's how governments are formed. That's how states or whatever, that's how people called government or called the state do it. You do as we say, and I'll quote you, because we said so. And that
that's
you,
right. Yeah.
Okay, not because there's any moral authority behind it, not because there's any rationality, because you even said it's not rational. It's because there are a bunch of individual men and women who are acting in an immoral way. And the only reason why people accept them is because they don't apply the same moral standard to people called government that they do to themselves and to their neighbor. Because if you did extend the same moral code that applies to the mundanes like me, there's no way in the world you can make a moral argument for what people called government do.
Well, just to clarify, I do think there's, I mean, I've tried to offer a few arguments to describe or even justify what government does, but I'm not saying that they're absolutely correct. They're simply theories offered to justify it. The other thing is, I agree that when the government asserts jurisdiction, for example, through the courts in a legal case, it simply starts from the position that it has jurisdiction. It's a blunt assertion of that.
Yeah.
And it's irrational in the sense that it's not rationalized. It's just an assertion of power and authority. Whether it lacks all rationality is a different issue. Again, I think that there are theories to justify it, and I would question whether the citizen who is compelled to pay taxes against his or her will is a victim in the same sense that a robbery victim is a victim. The person in that situation is completely apart from the robber or from the criminal. The taxpayer, the compelled taxpayer, is also a member of a democracy with rights to vote, rights to protest, rights to organize, rights to change, not rights, but the ability, in theory, to work together with others to gain a majority to change the Constitution, to change the law. So, they would have to do that, and they may not succeed, and in that case, you could say that they're always being coerced by the will of the majority. I think really that's the crux of your issue. I think your issue is what are a minority's rights in a constitutional democracy, and when you do have a minority, in what sense, to what extent can you really justify the coercive nature of the majority's will over the minority? I think that's really what we're talking about.
No. No,
but I mean that's my reading. I'm not okay. Saying you're wrong and I'm right, but I'm just saying that's how I read this set of facts.
Is it moral to force people to pay you if you claim to have a majority opinion that it's right?
Yes, I mean that's your question. I think that's the question. And I've offered one theory by which it can be moral. The democracy theory that, you're free to try to persuade your fellow community members, which you're doing, right? You are doing this. You're free to try to persuade them, and I would think that ultimately, in theory, your ultimate goal here is if enough people agreed with you, you could change the political constitution of the United States to allow for a much more, a much less coercive form of government, and I think it's important to realize that you have that freedom, that that's also, baked into the system in an important way. But, Mark, I need to stop you. I need to run very soon and take the kids to school. And it's parent-teacher day today, and so there's a whole bunch of things.
I understand, and we've gone way over what I had originally said, and I do appreciate that. Can I ask, just at one point maybe to ponder, is that given what you're saying that the judges just assume it's true, the judges are supposed to also be obligated to presume your innocence and not to assume something. So how do you square that? How do you square that, the presumption of innocence, with the assumption of a major part of the prosecutor's case?
Well, I think the simple answer is that it's not considered a part of the prosecutor's case. The prosecution has only to prove the elements of the offense. And jurisdiction is an element. So, identity, jurisdiction, and the actual particular elements of the offense, like, for example, theft, the mens rea and the actus reus of the offense. Jurisdiction is proved by merely establishing that you committed the offense in this jurisdiction, in this place. It is not an element of the offense. It is not something the Crown has to prove to establish that this court, this government, this state has the authority to prosecute you. Once again, that's actually...
How do you prove that a law was violated without first proving that it applies in the first place?
You don't. It's not...
You don't.
I'm speaking practically. In practical terms, it is not something we are in the practice of assuming we must prove.
I understand.
But as a philosophical matter, it's a good question. And I began by agreeing with you on that.
Oh, yeah. No, you've been very gracious with your time. I appreciate it. It's gone way over again what we – it's been a pleasure to talk with you. If we're able to do this again, I would really appreciate it. But I do appreciate your time, Mark.
It was a lot of fun chatting with you.
Yes, thank you very much. Have a good day.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
That was Mark Stevens and one of his No State Project videos, discussions with a law professor called Robert Diab. And I think we can quite see from that, can't we, what just exactly why it is that we don't really want to be hiring lawyers on this sort of business. was he not so reluctant to ask that first question about what evidence there was to back up the claim that these laws apply to us? I think he was asked the question 4 or 5 times. I think he successfully managed to avoid repeating himself in the various answers. But most striking, I thought, was the fact that he seemed utterly puzzled by the fact that anybody could even begin to countenance raising such a challenge. You know, the Crown wouldn't be asked to do it, the prosecutor wouldn't be asked to do it. It's just an axiomatic truth that the laws do apply, and that's how the whole thing moves forward. And this is precisely why I think the kind of approach that we might like to see doesn't necessarily work when in the hands of a lawyer. Because, of course, there's a difference between presenting as the beginning of your case, having turned up with this idea that that none of it actually applies to you, rather than, say, not turning up or turning up in handcuffs or whatever, and behaving in such a way that lets everyone know that it doesn't apply to you. And that is a completely different kettle of oysters. Nonetheless, in the end, the man was forced eventually to admit that the laws apply only because somebody says they apply. That it's not been justified by argument, it's not justified by the evidence, and that it's not justified by reason. One of the reasons I think why I like this particular video is, although it's maybe 45 minutes, it's a bit long for newbies and things like that, but when we're trying to explain these really rather complicated ideas, because most people are as puzzled by it, frankly, as that lawyer is, you know, well, we do have to have a system, and this is the system that we've got, then actually having something that you can play little bits of and say, there you go, look, there's a law professor actually saying that there isn't actually any validation for this. I thought also the... what would we call it, really? Is it an amorality, lack of morality? I'm not quite sure what the word is for the general tenor of Robert's approach to the whole thing, which is more or less to say, well, you know, it's just the violence on which the state has always been founded. I'm not sure where morality comes into that, he said. And again, a bit like he was a bit puzzled by the fact that anybody might even countenance such a question as this, was the complete failure, I think, to put any moral weight onto something that the interviewer, Mark, was obviously trying to draw out as something of a moral subject. Anyway, I thought it was quite useful because you can actually hear somebody saying exactly what it is that's been said on here and in other places for quite a long time. Very interesting to hear the way the lawyer can dance around a subject and still sound reasonably creditable. And 10 out of 10 to Mark, I thought, for his quiet persistence and for the gentle shaving of questions, as like a bit like a boa constrictor, as he kind of squeezed a bit more breath out of the guy and got another tiny concession. Then the question changed just a little bit as a result, forcing the next eventual concession. I thought a very instructive 40 minutes of chat. Hope you enjoyed it as much as I did. I know Nick's been listening to it as well, so perhaps we'll get back to that a bit later. Right now, though, we're going to have a bit of a music break, 6 or 7 minutes of music, and when we come back, we'll be coming back live with Nick Nomick to describe and talk to us about what it is that brought him into this interesting area of investigation and experimentation that we find ourselves all sharing in. In the meantime, big hi to all of you in the chat box. Hi to everybody in the kitchen posse. Good to hear you all out there. And here comes the Buffalo Skinners, and You Make Your Own Life Hard. Oh, yes. There you go. Catatonia's Strange Glue from the marvellous International Velvet album. And we're back listening live to Dr. Rock's radio show here on peoplesinternetradio.com, where we are, as usual, seeking solutions. And tonight, at last, after almost 5 years on the air, I'm joined by Nick Nomick, one of my favourites. Hi there, Nick. Thanks for coming on, bud.
Hiya, Doc. It has been so amazingly long time coming up, but it feels a bit weird being out on the main stage at this time of night.
Ah, oh, there you go. Well, it's okay. You're in the... You're in the navigator's seat, like I say. Hopefully you've got a chilled glass of paraffino on one side and a Danish pastry and stuff, and it's great to have you on such a late-night visit.
Oh, it was well overdue, and I think time and circumstances sort of put it together.
Well,
and
but
we need some of it.
Yeah, it's a bit good. It's good to be celebrating the new Thursday night schedule. I think I'm really happy to have the three of us kind of running together on a Thursday night.
It's almost back where it was. Yeah. The deja vu of I was originally there doing welfare-y, and you were there in the middle, and then Jack was finishing it up.
Yeah. Yeah, we've had to bide our time, haven't we? It's taken a while for us to re-establish our supremacy on Thursdays, but here we are once more.
Oh, it does feel wonderful. I mean, I have to say, no word of a lie, I feel I have possibly the best job I could wish for in terms of being the warm-up act. And, you know, I'm not trying to make light of it. I just really enjoy being there and doing that thing. And it's therapy and enjoyment.
It made such a difference to me when you decided to do that, because I'd been on my own on Thursday night for really quite a bloody long time by the time you decided to do that. Yeah. And it helps prepare for this show a lot better when there's somebody on there and the chat box is lively, and me and the Kitchen Posse, we really like the music and Podgy play as well. And of course, it's always great to hear Wild Swan occasionally as well. Talking of which, I must remember Main Admin sends her warmest greetings to you and Wild Swan. I don't want to forget that. So lots of love to you from her.
Oh well, it's wonderful. It's wonderful to have people like this. It's great. I feel it's like hanging around with good friends, most of whom I've never met face to face, but I've learnt so much about.
I think the last 5 years would have been hugely difficult without everybody here. Myself,
a group intent has been everything. Now, I mean, I know there's stories from way back in the very early days before our time of people out there all by themselves plugging away. And I think I would have found it hard to have been someone setting out in that role, but to have joined in the sense to have followed Jack here from TPUC all those many years ago, mm-hmm. and suddenly found this radio with this strange chat box and some wonderful, crazy, inspiring people.
Is that how you came to TNS? Is it in did you arrive in Jack's trick top hat? Did you?
I'd seen Jack about. I think we generally exchanged some comments in the TPUC forums, which was in a sense a random event in itself. I just happened to be looking at things regarding council tax, helping someone else out, and stumbled on John Harris and then TPUC, and I found a few people there, and I was a bit put off at certain behaviour was already prevalent. I don't think it got much better, and I'm not sure what TPUC is up to now, but it just so happened there was this guy, and I thought, I've seen you about, and I'd seen some comments, and I think you sort of pick up very slight references, even just in language, and I think there was mention of travellers or certain things from the past, and I thought, I should go and check this guy on radio. And I think I wandered in here to find Jack. And I may have just dipped in and out just listening to Jack for a couple of weeks, but then I started to find a few other things and other hosts, some of which are long gone, but I think always inspiring. Even when you find sometimes the atmosphere gets a bit low, you never can quite tell that within a day or two, someone will come in here and completely blow your mind with something new.
Yes, yeah. Well, I think everything has its astrology, doesn't it? We all have kind of peaks and troughs, and PIR, TNS has definitely gone through those. I agree, though, people do keep turning up, and it doesn't matter how many brilliant people you hear. They're just around the corner, there'll be another one.
Yeah. I think there's always something different. I'm loving seeing the new guys come in. I've only recently discovered Andy's shows because I was always missing them, grabbing meals and stuff, and really enjoying what's coming with him. And I caught briefly some of Danielle's stuff. And, you know, we have people come, we have some people go. I'm not sure how many people out there might actually turn up again at somewhere around. You never quite know what might happen at any moment.
That's funny how they don't seem to come back, isn't it?
I don't know. I think some people go off and continue on their way. I think there's certain people I'd love to come back and chat to. I know I don't want to put anything out there because I think I'd rather just talk to Welfare-y mm-hmm. privately at first. I wouldn't really want to encourage her towards coming back on radio unless you felt the need to come. But, you know, she's more than welcome to come and heckle me on my show.
I think it's a fairly widely known fact that I really mourned the loss of the Well Fairy show, and I think there's huge space for it or something like it on PIR, because it's such a massive area of challenge.
It became really hard work. This is the unfortunate problem, is that we were relying on expertise we couldn't keep updated.
Mm.
It was hard to be responsible with it. You know, we were faced with a choice. We're going to have to put in a lot of hours to keep up to date on the technical side.
You effectively needed your own full-time research team, didn't you, really, just to keep on top of day-by-day changes?
Yeah, I mean, in terms of, it's still going now, and I still have my own personal stuff cooking up that I will probably bring through when I can actually make it more public. Some of it is still actually pending, and I might have to go and sit in a room with one of those big insignias on the wall and talk to people about it.
Yeah.
So, I want to put certain things out on that. If I come across people that I can maybe share some information with more privately and try and deal with it, you know, deal with things in a quiet way, because I think it's easier to get a resolution with that.
It's got to be really resolved privately before it can be talked about publicly, I would have thought, hasn't it?
I think to an extent it's more a matter of get the situation over with. If someone wants to bring it to her, or, you know, even at the least, because it's very confidential, and, you know, we've dealt with disabled people and people in very difficult situations. And I don't think... It almost started to separate that we were doing things outside the radio, that it didn't seem appropriate to have people putting so much out there and making it so public.
Yeah, yeah.
I think we were always trying to come back and say, put some general ideas behind it, or highlight specific things that people could use. And it was quite a difficult thing to deal with. You know, it was an emotional thing, and I think we almost felt, I mean, I have to say, very much credit to Wild Swan, is that when she and Well Fairy got together and had their little chats, it created such a wonderful different energy in the middle that, you know, it lifted us when we were getting about the midway point, and it was hard work.
Yeah. Yeah, I guess that's one of the things, isn't it, is that you'd need quite a big team in order to spread that kind of stress.
Yeah, and I think in some ways, I've sort of seen some of this. I have seen hosts that I think, sadly, maybe could have, with a little bit of support, might have held on in a bit more. And I think sometimes if we were busy or a bit short and some people didn't get support, and I think that would be my tragedy, is that someone wasn't able to do it just for that want of not being able to deal with a specific workload and hoping that there's people out there. And we usually do catch it. Yeah, more often than not, there are people around here, and we have to help each other out.
Mm.
And I think, but it's part of the spirit that keeps us going, is we stay together, and we've had some crazy ups and downs. You know, without going too far into the past and looking at the really emotional stuff, we seem to have come through some amazing things that you would have been surprised if it hadn't ended at quite a few points.
Mm. Yeah, yep. Perseverance, really. And we have to be able to support each other, most especially in the difficult times, really, isn't it?
And yes, and I think almost I have to acknowledge, I don't think times are going to get better, if anything, the opposite. I think, you know, we have to look to each other now, because I would imagine things, there seems to be a lot of things cooking up, and I don't pay too much attention to the media, but stuff still gets through. And there seems to be some very... very scary attitudes in certain places.
Yes, I agree. The game does seem to be hardening most noticeably.
Yeah.
It does, but, I mean, in the end, one of the things we've noticed, isn't it, is that for a start-off, people tend not to start taking action, even if they've started wakening up a little in advance. They don't tend to start taking action until their own butt is against the wall, and that we are at our most creative... when we're under pressure, I think it's not necessarily to our advantage that that's the way it works, but it's certainly the way it has been for a while.
I mean, absolutely. I think we're coming across people doing all sorts of things now. I think I'm meeting people who have come from the mainstream. You know, not everybody was in a state of rebellion. I think people have been frustrated by the way things have changed. And to some extent, so many people are standing up now because they really don't seem to have much option left.
No, that's exactly right. I think we'll know that things have changed significantly when we do see large numbers of people changing before that option-free stage is reached, if you like.
Mm. I mean, I think there's certain things. I mean, I specifically look to certain areas in terms of trying to contact activists. I've been chatting on Facebook to a few people in the fracking areas and trying to talk to them, because only coming on information is that it's not just the fracking issue is important. I think I was coming across other information of saying the way they are structured with the companies and the investments, it might be a good place to apply pressure, because the financial side of the business might collapse the actual business itself if we can slow it down enough.
There is a school of thought, isn't there, which suggests that in fact the whole fracking thing is in fact more of a financial instrument than it is a physical thing on the ground. That actually a whole lot more money is being made out of the money and the investments than will ever be made out of the oil or the gas.
Yes, I mean I think I had a pod from that quite a way back. I'm trying to recall which one it was now. But I think that sort of changed my perspective. It's a case of, yes, of course, they see this. They've created a speculative bubble which only gets bigger. Mm-hmm. And it's almost a repeat of the same old thing, which has not been put a stop to.
No.
Nope. Yeah, it's not like there are new problems facing. It's a variation on the old ones.
Money for nothing.
Yeah. And I think, you know, you have to say that. I think even someone who would consider, you know, an extreme view here, say someone who happens to wander in here new, who still has faith in a sort of democratic system and maybe a political solution. I know that's a big ask for a lot of people in here, but even on that, it's a case of there doesn't seem to be a middle ground way forward to accommodate that. You know, you would think you might be able to negotiate a rolling back of the state, but it would seem they've become so entrenched in their position, it's hard to see any ground being given.
Yes, well, the state and its agencies, various branches of government, just does get inevitably bigger and bigger and bigger. We don't ever see. Well, I don't think it's anybody even putting forward arguments for small government anymore.
It doesn't seem to happen. I think even if the comments are that they want to sort of reduce the bureaucratic load, it doesn't happen. It seems to roll around and come back round again with even more. I mean, I know Wildswan gave me an example. One of her friends who, and they actually have free-range livestock. They're not certified organic because of the extra paperwork and cost. And she has free-range Dorset cattle, and they go for beef. I'm not going to mince around about that, but these are country people. And there's a lot of countryside issues that I have to be a little bit pragmatic and take a middle ground on. But anyway, this woman, they run cattle. They make their living off that. They're an old school country family. But she is getting DEFRA involved now, saying they want an electric fence up because the cattle may damage the hedgerow. And this is a woman who thinks, I now need to actually try and phone them up and explain to them that my cattle need access to the hedgerow because that's their medicine cabinet. That's where they will go and browse and self-medicate.
And it's not the cattle that are damaging the bloody hedgerows, it's the farmers.
You know, it's a case of the hedgerows are getting ripped up far enough for bigger and bigger acreage.
They get flailed here as well. We've got a lot of ancient hedges, but they come along and they just absolutely savage them. And this is one of the things that really, really irks me about all of these kind of planning and protection authorities or whatever they are, is that when it suits them, they will stand up in protection of hedges. But, you know, in that bus ride I had from the middle of Wales all the way up to Scotland the other week, all I saw was grass, sheep and knackered hedges. So to be going for somebody who's running a few cattle and insist they put up an electric fence without whilst failing to address the extremely upsetting state of the hedges everywhere. And like you say, there's a lot of them being pulled up as well.
I see it more up close is because I'm in a suburban environment. You have, obviously, I think there are people working probably now on contract to the council who possibly served in the horses, because you can see dead straight lines on the hedges. Mm-hmm. You know, the guy in charge is that, you know, he's doing his job. He believes he's doing a great thing. And it's saddening to see what's happening in that respect. And I think there's so much of what really is traditional countryside going. I can't really recall whether it, you know, to an extent, not a great deal of it down here is ancient, because it's been shaped by man for a long time. But it seems to be totally getting away from how it was purposed in the first place.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I don't know about where you are, but we see no arable land here at all. And we would have grown wheat and corn and oats, absolutely, yes. Tons and tons and tons of oats on the hills of Wales. And now, like I say, just grass and sheep, really.
Mm. Well, I think the main thing to see, generally, you see the yellow flowers of the oilseed rape. I know if we go up to Salisbury Plain, we see fields of white poppies. I don't know if that's presumably for the seed or for something in particular, but you do see the monocrop. We have, where we are down the south, there is a great deal of open country, but not a great deal of it's worked in terms of general crop planting. I mean, I'm seeing tiny, tiny things of hope of talking to the Dorset Cop Society about woodworking and where we get to go to the shows, we get to the country and the craft shows, and seeing that there are people out there desperately trying to keep some of this stuff alive, and some of them succeeding very well, but far too small a number to be making a serious difference.
I still see at the moment that at least that does give us the kind of, if you like, the basic small knowledge banks that we need. There's plenty of room for people to be doing things like repairing tools, and I'm not sure that the awareness has fully arisen yet. But the tools you get from the tool shops nowadays are very, very poor indeed. And I've seen many bent spades and spades with broken handles and things, more or less as soon as the instant they've come out the shelf, as soon as you put them to any kind of work at all, they break. And there's a different quality to all of the old tools, all of the old spades and forks and things like that, and they're all repairable. And the skills to do that have not yet vanished. And it's my hope that more people will take to them, partly because it'll be a way of scraping a living. You know, repairing tools will be a useful thing to be able to be doing.
I mean, it's the necessity of it. I think the one thing that really made my heart sing was we got to go to, there was a local wood fair down here, and the best part of all, and it was basically swamped out with males. You could tell which stalls had the axes and the hand tools because they were packed.
Yeah.
You know, it was blokes in there, and it was, I mean, there's a friend of ours now, he already has a selection of three different axes for chopping his logs in the backyard, and he walked up very sheepishly with another one. He said, "It just felt so right in my hand." And you sort of smile because it's a case of, you sort of know what it means, of something like that you feel has a character. I mean, one of my things, certainly from going way back, is talking to the country people on the shape and the nature of the billhooks,
yeah,
that are used across the country, and how each one has a different shape to deal with different species or various hedge techniques. And to actually talk to people who know that sort of stuff is, you know, that's a moment of wonder.
Yes, yes, we meet quite a lot of such people out here.
Mm.
Largely because out here is where such people need to come now if they want to still be doing what they do and getting some recognition and payment for it, I think.
Well, I think it's one of the few remaining spaces. It's not a big island, and there's so many parts of it getting so built up. It's hard to be rural. I mean, we're one of the few lucky counties. We don't have motorway. I think we're one of the only counties in England that has no motorway running through it.
Really? Oh, wow.
Yes. I think that may have a great deal to do with the fact that large parts of the county are in big packages of private estates.
Yeah.
I think there's like a hidden area here, you know, say between here and the Cotswolds. This is sort of like the relaxing area away from the bigger cities. Because I do know, I'm not dismissing chemtrails at all, but I do seem to see a rare amount some of the time.
Mm. Yeah, once again, because of your big, presumably because of your big estate. So which county are you in?
We're on the edge of Bournemouth. In theory, on the eastern edge of Bournemouth, going into the countryside area.
So is that Dorset?
Yes.
Yeah.
We were in the centre of Bournemouth at a time, with a tiny place and a small backyard, but we sort of drifted out to the edge. I would love to be drifting out further into the rural areas.
Did you find it made a lot of difference to your internal space when you moved closer to external space?
Oh, yes. I was very much affected. I spent time, I'd lived in a caravan prior to coming back under a brick walls and a tiled roof. That was about a year or so by myself, and that, you know, that's a different experience. I think, as we've discussed before, I travelled very early on, so I think I like that sensation of being closer to the elements. I feel a little bit hemmed in inside brick walls and things, but certainly having more open space, having a better garden to wander about in when the weather gets better, improves things. And I've not long been a dog owner. You know, to an extent, I spend a lot of my adult life without a dog, so that changes the dynamic again of being out and in different places.
Yeah. So what was it that brought you to TNS? Was it benefit issues? Was it the thing you were doing with the council tax, or was it issues to do with your life on the road, or a combination of all three?
There wasn't really anything specific. There was just, you know, I think sometimes a feeling, there's an instinct that it's a case of there's interesting stuff going on here. There wasn't a particular pressing issue. I think when I first got here, it was a case of they were quite wide-ranging discussions. Certainly gave me something to think about, which I think I'd been absent from for a while. I'd been drifting for quite a while. But I'd start to meet people locally, because I've lived down here on the South Coast. Certainly long enough to tone down the Scouse accent I was born with. But, you know, definitely, I hadn't really connected out with many people, but I started to connect with a lot of people who were reading books and actually having discussion. Not just like the people I'd had as workmates who I couldn't really discuss. Once you give up TV, you have nothing to discuss with them. And almost seeing the burden of work pile up on people and pressure, and it tended to cut down any sort of spirit that was in the working environment that made it fun and worthwhile.
Yeah.
But it was getting out and finding, oh, there are people who turn off the TV like me, and they actually read some books, and they actually discuss philosophy or different things. And, I mean, I've had so many wide-ranging discussions. Certainly talking to my pagan friends, I have quite debates about Mr. Crowley, because I have very serious misgivings, as I believe wouldn't be inconsistent with most people here. But there's certain people who think he has merit, and I'm prepared to give them a bit of room sometimes. But certainly some other stuff in terms of things I feel more akin to now. I've always felt weird connections to nature, and certainly always an interest in the curious things at the edge of our reality. I enjoy looking at that in itself.
So you've always been kind of floating around the edge of the non-orthodox then?
I mean, to me, it's a case of even as a child, you know, I think it was probably stuff coming from my dad, or, you know, I think even for most of us, you get the Star Trek stuff and everything else, but it was sort of seeing, he liked his sci-fi books. I think I got Asimov through him. He certainly gave me Lord of the Rings. I don't think he expected I'd be sitting there reading it however many times around for about 7 or 8 years. And certainly all the other things of to an extent, pretty much most of the content of the X-Files in terms of all the unexplained phenomena, which I was thinking was at the edges of science and close to being more explainable.
Yeah.
Because there seemed to be quite a bright, shining future at that time as a small child. You know, tomorrow's world had great promise.
Yes, that's one of the things I wanted to ask you was you know, how different was it? Because I've spent a bit of time thinking about that recently, about what it was like being a child, you know, and running around and drinking from the water fountain and, you know, blue skies and all of that. And I think they were working harder at cultivating the idea of a bright new tomorrow in those days, don't you? So much of it now, you know, the robots are going to do all the work and you can all job share and only work 2 days a week. It'll be great.
Yeah. I mean, it to some extent, I mean, I hark back, and I think it was, again, Jack who steered me back on that. It was Buckminster Fuller saying, in theory, science should take away the labour element. We should be able to be people of leisure. You know, that was part of the utopian vision that was being sold at the time. I mean, only from having, we had some distant relatives in the States and actually seeing how the way Disney shaped this Epcot, which was meant to be a concept, not just of a tourist destination, but as a working city, that people would commute into and out of and would be a model for the future century, that didn't seem to quite come about.
A working city.
Yeah.
Oh, you see these brown signs out here saying working farm, which I always find quite funny. We're going to start seeing brown signs saying working city.
Well, I think in a sense of it was using the huge design skill of saying they had specific transport hubs and, you know, I think using how architecture was looking at that time, you know, towards huge visions of space and things.
Yeah.
And maybe seeing how far they could actually push it, even just to do it as a one-off concept to show it. But it just never seemed to come about. But I think the corporate world just sort of took everything over. And I think, you know, we have to look at part of this. If the corporate world hadn't been so pervasive or so greedy, would we be at this point now?
It does seem to have ramped up at some point, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. So you basically had like a lot, my impression with a lot of us is that that we have this kind of cloud of stuff around us that's made up of the various readings and things that we seem more or less coincidentally to have been doing as younger people, you know, might be around sci-fi, might be around mythology and shamanism, things like that, might be around alternative views and history. But a lot of us have kind of been in that sort of realm, haven't we, for a long time before the hard edginess of the world actually starts breaking into our consciousness. But most of us have kind of some early experiences where we start to become aware of that. What was it for you? Did you have a particular event that made you realise that maybe things were a bit more Mordor and less Elven Quest?
I don't know, maybe more. I think I noticed one. I commented on it, and it sort of came back to my memory. I think there were a couple of times certainly in school days, I think there were two specific times that stuck in my head, one in the biology class and one in the physics class, where I asked a question, and the response was, don't be so stupid. And there was an emotion to it.
Yeah.
And it's a case of, you sort of instinctively think, hang on, I touched a nerve there, and you didn't quite know why. But it's a case of, that's obviously something that I want to come back to in a different time and place.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the physics one was over my physics teacher trying to explain to me that light was a wave and a particle. And I think I'm sort of getting back to that now. I think some of Jack's podcasts are sort of dealing with that answer quite nicely now. Mm. I mean, the other one on biology I worked at a while back was just, I think it was a general question about evolution. And it was a case of, I think, the biology teacher coming back to me and saying, well, evolution is a fact. And I thought, well, hang on. Did I miss this change in status?
Yeah.
you know, the theory of evolution is a fact. Now shut up. And it's a case of hold on a moment. That's not how I thought science was done.
No. No, and some of the basic predictions have yet to be fulfilled, haven't they? Although
generally, I mean, in a sense, it's a case of there's merit in that model. And I know in the one thing that I think, again, PIR steered me towards Bruce Lipton. And I think Bruce Lipton, filling some of the background, I generally knew about Darwin. He wasn't the ship's biologist. I think he was taken on board at last minute as someone's friend. He
Is
only
that right? Just, I didn't know that. I didn't
yeah,
know
I
that.
Think he was taken on as the medic or something. I think the official ship's biologist was his mate who got him on. And he then jumped ship in South America or something, so he was sort of left with the job. But I think it was the Bruce Lipton thing of he referenced that Darwin had effectively not plagiarised, more been inspired by, I think.
Yeah.
Being generous. I think there was a guy who went before, French guy whose name I forget, and he talked about not survival of the fittest, but thrival of the mostest. Mm-hmm. Which I think is a very subtle twist in terms of we cooperate, we carry as many people with us as we can.
Yes.
It's not this selfish, I'm all right, Jack stuff. It's a case of the benefit of all is worthwhile.
Yeah, I think there's also the question of whether the amount of time that is deemed to be necessary for genetic development and things like that is actually valid, because there seems to me to be a whole lot of evidence in the geological record, and actually more and more evidence from human medical investigation as well, that DNA re-expression can happen on quite a wide scale, more or less instantaneously, and it can certainly happen in individual entities as an instantaneous expression, really. Things can change just like that.
I mean, yes, to an extent. I know from, I think, what was it, Prometheus Rising, of having gone through that and saying, you know, there are stages in the human development, and, you know, we are at a point, it would seem that there is a point of a jump. It's not not necessarily a gradual progression. To an extent, I think we are a small bunch of people here. I think, you know, I think everyone here has been hoping, and I think we've been hanging in here, of at some point do we hit a critical mass? You know, if we hit like 200 listeners, do we then start this morphic resonance off and we're going to get it? You know, we're suddenly going to go from 200 to some sort of crazy amount.
Yes.
And it feels like that's what we seem to be plugging away on, that somehow we might just hit something, or someone else. We might come across someone else's idea and we can actually gather to a specific idea on it.
That's right. It can be just momentary interaction with a single individual or a single event can utterly transform things, which, of course, I think is why, isn't it? It's why we're here plugging away at it. We come up, as we touched on earlier on, every now and then with really amazing people and really astonishing interviews of personal experience and personal testimony of what can be achieved. And that's good enough for the moment. What we don't know, like you say, is when we're going to see exponential growth as a result of... it won't be just a matter of somebody turning up. It'll be because of somebody turning up in a place where there's already a groundswell of experience and support for the ideas they're expressing. It won't be entirely, you know, a kind of an independent explosion as it was. It will be a combination, I'm sure, of individual experience and the huge accumulated experience on PIR now. And that could happen any moment now.
Yeah, I think you have to keep that sense of it. I'm finding it hard to see. I keep getting Douglas Adams things come together. I want to say, like, bang the rock, keep banging the rocks together. You know, I think we've just got to keep doing our thing and trying to push the good stuff. I think it would seem it stood the test of time, the idea of seeking solutions. It seems like a good place to be starting from.
It certainly makes people a lot more, it's a really good way of calming situations, I think, is to try and move conversations away from opposition and arguments about what, as we were talking earlier, are quite often secondary points, and instead try to look at the basis of what those points are and try and draw people's attention. Well, ask them, you know, so you got any ideas what we might do about it? People quite often have.
I think there's always people willing to, I mean, to an extent it's having a go. We may not have all the answers, but it's a case of we think we might be able to do something about this little bit, and we might be able to do something on that little bit, and if other people can come in and do the small bits in between. And there may be certain bigger bits. I know there's certain issues that we can't deal with. They're just too big to be looking at. But we can start to work around the edges of them or try to engage people to start looking at how to fix them.
Well, ultimately, I often feel about the big things that they're arising as a result of a failure to see to the small things. And whilst we do appear to be reaching the very edge of time, as it were, we do appear to be under pressure of time, still it applies that the only way of dealing with the big things is to start dealing with the smaller problems that are setting them up. I mean, I don't know what you think the key issues are there.
I'm not sure. I think there was one I remember I hit on a while back, and I thought, it's a simple thing to say. It's a long journey to embark on. But I think one of the key things I looked at, and we keep seeing the topic come round again, is, all right, let's look at one of the most basic elemental things.
Have a mic. Do I have a mic? Yeah, there we go. Nervous, Norvus, and Transfusion there, preceded by ZZ Top, I'm Bad, I'm Nationwide, which was preceded by the total disappearance of everything from my desktop, such that all that was working was suddenly not there anymore. So, very sorry about that. I'm not sure I was actually doing anything at the time, but honestly, Laurie, it wasn't me and the buttons. Honest, it wasn't. Not this time. Anyway, at least it convinces you that we are genuinely real people, and this is genuinely live radio, peoplesinternetradio.com, and it's Dr. Rock on the buttons. So if anybody was responsible, it was not me and not my worthy guest, Nick. Can you still hear me, Nick?
I hope I'm still in there somewhere. I can hear myself and I can hear you.
That's good, I can hear you too, and all the meters seem to be working all right. I'm sure somebody on the chat box will tell us. Yeah, there we go, main admin saying we're loud and clear. At least we're getting a little bit better at handling these collapses after 5 years or so, eh?
I think it's the point of you've got to sort of deal when it happens, because it can't, you know, even if you get everything right, your end on your computer, you get some eddies in the space-time continuum and the internet decides to throw a bit of a moody. And, you know, there are some nights when it's good and some nights when it's not. And there are some nights when we mess up totally. But we seem to be getting the hang of it. I think we seem to have better tools to do the job with.
We certainly do. We love our open source software, don't we, Nick?
It really worked wonders. You know, I think the one thing I will say is I found it quite nerve-wracking of having a lot of buttons to coordinate. And certainly having spent some time with it and worked out that I can automate so many things, and it takes care of a lot. As I'd expect really a well-behaved computer to do it, is it will play tunes and I can say, right, I want you to stop here, and it does it. And when you get to the end, it's like the ending in its case, if you can just watch it do its thing and do a little bit of interaction and make sure it hands over well, it gives you more time to concentrate on what's really going on. And I'm loving it.
Yeah, well, let's face it, there is plenty to concentrate on doing this job. It's the more of the actual engineering bit that can automate itself, the better. That's what I say. I don't suppose there stands a snowball's chance in hell of you remembering what we were talking about when all of that happened, do I?
The only thing I was vaguely, I knew where I was gearing up to.
Oh, man, let's go there.
I was going to say, even if we do one, this is one I did a way back, and it's case of, all right, let's take a basic principle. Let's give everyone in the world clean, drinkable, accessible water everywhere as much as possible across the world, and have that as a goal and just start doing our little bits towards making sure that any water source can be cleaned and remediated and looked after and held in trust for everybody.
And that people who are actively damaging water supplies should be held accountable.
I think in terms of, you know, you're talking in terms of, it's not just for us as life forms, it's every life form on the planet, and you're endangering our life support mechanisms You know, it should be considered an extremely serious thing. We shouldn't be in a situation, I know, to look at something very current now, is we have a place in Michigan, and I've seen some of the water they draw off and how toxic it's been, and these people are expected to be still handing over money. And then to hear a new twist on the case of further down the road, there is a large Nestle water bottling plant that's drawing clean water, paying no charges for it, but taking it out of a common aquifer. That's really, it's a common property, not just for the people alive and living in that area, but their generations to come later. And we have corporate companies that take this resource, stick it in some plastic, which is just making the problem worse, and then want to charge money for it.
Well, this is one of the things that we're doing here, isn't it? I mean, if we can get into trouble for putting our bins out on the wrong day or for putting plastic in with the cardboard or whatever it is, then why is it that people are not getting into trouble for making money by poisoning entire cities' water supplies? It just doesn't seem right, doesn't it? It doesn't seem to be a question that's asked commonly either.
It seems to come down to the root of the problem is we are expected to do more. The ordinary citizen or ordinary person, and you know, I'm using those words advisedly, there seems to be a lot of regulation coming down on the single individual. But in terms of if you become a large group with power and money, it would seem that there are layers and layers of exemptions and ways to work around the taxation system or certain money exchange system. It seems that that amount of power grants you privileges that it isn't fair to have being in that position. You know, I think you would have, if you were to deal with things in terms of the general people of the planet and say, if the corporations were treated the same as us, I don't think anyone could argue with that. An extent, you know, without even going into the fact that they're fiction and they shouldn't be allowed to take from the commons, even on that basic thing, they wouldn't. To an extent, the uprising is going to come because they are so greedy and they don't stop.
Mm. Yeah.
You know, that's about the one thing I think. But we have to look at, we have a life support system. And like it or not, whatever NASA may be saying or whatever anywhere else may be saying, we don't seem to have a backup option on this. And it does look that there's some very serious things gone on because people have been very careless with nuclear stuff or chemicals or trying to dig oil out of all sorts of weird and wonderful places and all the other things that we seem to have got very tied into and driven by a money system. And you know, we sort of see some of the ludicrousness of this, but it's very hard to get that word out there and to actually see that there's so many things that seem to be almost unstoppable at the moment.
Well, again, I think the water's quite an interesting example, isn't it? Because it's not so bad in Wales where we don't have the fluoride, but and the chlorine's not too bad around here. But in several places it is. And I know many people now who literally can't make tea out of the water that's coming out of the taps. Now, I'm not sure their attention had been brought to the quality of their water before, and they're now showing a bit more interest into just exactly what there is in there, but this means that people are now becoming aware that they're being made to pay for something that isn't even actually adequate to their needs. And again, although it seems to be commonly noticed, it's not so commonly questioned. You know, well, do we want to pay the money for something which we can't really even make tea out of?
Precisely. You know, if it's not what it's claiming to be. I mean, I don't go into, I would find the prospect of going to a supermarket these days scary, because I know that there are going to be so many of the aisles that are going to have all the garish colours of the packets and things, which I've become really sensitised to, and it's a case of, it's not food.
No.
It took me a long time to realise it's a case of, that's not food, that's food stuff.
Yeah.
And there's a very, very big difference between the two.
They do call them food stuffs, yeah, good point.
I mean, Nestle are very precise in their language. They are the leading producer of foodstuffs.
Yeah.
You know, the language, they know exactly what's going on. I think it'd be very hard for them to claim that they were not aware of these things.
Yeah, and apparently I was hearing the other day that now, and there's a big list in this report, and Nestle were amongst them, Kraft were amongst them, Campbell's condensed soups. I think the conclusion was that anybody that's been required to remove large amounts of salt and sugar from their products, so I should include that, I should imagine that includes Heinz, although I didn't see them on the list. What they're apparently doing is using extracts from aborted fetuses to create things that to create flavorings that, whilst are not in themselves sweet or salty, do create the impression of that. And right across the board, apparently, these genetically modified kind of fetus matter is being put into food to replace sugar and salt.
Absolutely. You actually just reminded me, we had one from way, way back. And I won't go into the full depth of the story, but there was something that came out through Wild Swan on the Welfare Show way back. And it's one thing. If anyone has a fondness for anything that is raspberry flavoured, I want to put this out to certain people, because this was put out way, way back by Wild Swan, probably 4 years ago, that the main ingredient that they source for the specific raspberry flavour you'll find everywhere is from a musk beaver anal glands.
Okay, they taste the raspberries, do they? I wonder who found that out.
This is where the mind starts to boggle and I tend to back away. And it's a case of where was that connection made? You know, was it, you know, in theory, you'd like to think that science actually sat down and worked on their little chemical diagrams and sort of thought, oh, that's very similar to raspberry flavour. Who would want to be that one person, you know, who's actually given the dish and say, well, taste that and tell us what you think it is. Mm-hmm. And I think it's certain realisations of some of that. And, I mean, we have to acknowledge is that as a species, we have done over time an amount of selective breeding. And, you know, in the way seeds were saved and things, there was an amount of selection and things going on, and man interfered. Maybe not necessarily always to the best, but it was done at a very slow and steady pace. And we have to say that the pace of things going on, I think to hearing things that, to some extent, it would seem that some of the Monsanto plans are falling apart, that their Roundup ready crops that can only use their pesticides aren't working anyway.
Which I don't think they were ever going to, really.
Mm. But I think in certain ways they're saying to some extent, from what I gather, I'm not a lover of soy, but from what I gather, it's a case of you cannot consider that any soy now is GMO-free.
No, I think that's absolutely correct. I think to a certain extent it's kind of true of wheat as well.
Mm. And I have to say, I don't know, I have to apologise there if I was a little bit too forthright. I think I'm just seeing Joe made a comment in the chat about raspberries.
God.
And I think there is only one solution, is grow loads of them and hope the birds leave you some.
Make sure your raspberry flavouring comes from actual raspberries.
Yes. I think if it says raspberry flavour, it's a case of, it's to an extent that is telling you the truth. It's saying it's not raspberries.
No.
Yeah, I've seen things of so many stuff, and it's been a long time since I read the labels. I'm not allowed to accompany Wild Swan in the supermarket. I tend to, you know, I'm reading labels and commenting, and it got a little, it held her back, really. And
I was never much of a label reader. I now tend to buy things that I don't need to read the labels on, because they don't put labels on carrots, for example. But
exactly.
Some of these things, I mean, you just be absolutely amazed at what's in them. Like you can come across a thing that's labelled as mushroom pate, implying, because some mushroom pates are just mushroom pates. And it implies that the mushroom pate is what it's called, is that it's mostly made out of mushroom. But I did actually come across a mushroom pate recently, which was in fact mostly made out of pork. But the pork was extremely low down on the list and could easily have been missed. But there was considerably more of it than there was of the mushrooms. And Also, I'm not really sure how accurate the labelling is, because they're not necessarily forced anymore to create new artificial sweeteners, haven't they, which it's not obligatory to mention them on the label and things like that.
Oh, I know they're playing plenty of tricks. I think the one thing I'm seeing, and I think we saw it early, it seems to actually come from where we were looking in terms of dogs specifically and pet nutrition, is we did see very early on in there is that a great deal of the dog food is done to quite a loose formula, but it's mainly to satisfy the current labelling ingredients, which say percentage of protein, percentage of fat. And it's the case that they can substitute the protein type as long as they keep the percentage up. And we saw it a great deal more. There was things I had to come back to the internet and look up of, I'd not heard of what a fodder beet was. And they said it's effectively something like a Swede or a sugar beet.
That's right.
It's only grown as animal food, really, for cattle.
That's right. It's a bit like a mangel wurzel.
Oh, right. I know about mangel wurzel. Mm-hmm. And I've had that brewed into something called no end of chaos and fun.
Can you still see?
The mangel wine. Yeah. No, I think it certainly got a bit blurry, the bit I remember. But it's a case of you're feeding basically a root vegetable, in theory, for cattle, to dogs, and it mainly goes in the mix because it's got a protein content. It's not the right sort of protein content that a dog would generally be looking at, but it means they can cut back on the meat. Yeah. So as long as they're keeping the percentages going, that's what's happy. And we seem to be doing this. The science seems to have turned against us, and we see more and more. It's a case of, well, yeah, we're getting to that point of a human being needs so many calories or this or that and the other. It doesn't matter how we cram them into them. We're sort of putting measurements on these daily levels. And as long as you get in some form, the fact that it might not be digestible, it just might not work, doesn't seem to be the issue.
No. And anyway, they'll only be giving us their ideas of how much protein we need and things like that. I shouldn't think they'd be paying any kind of notice at all to all the other trace elements that really should be in the vegetables as well.
I mean, that in itself, it's, you have to wonder, and I think the point to be made on here a lot is that the NHS deals with sick people. There doesn't seem to be anyone thinking of doing science of what are healthy people like and how do we keep them that way, or make sure your health is so good that you're not getting ill.
Yes, yeah, and certainly from the food they feed people in hospitals, as far as I can gather, they don't seem to think that nutrition's necessarily got a lot to do with it anyway.
Yeah, and I think that's balanced with the fact that they have a budget cut to the bone anyhow.
Yeah.
You know, the extras that are left over don't really run to having better catering.
But you know, really, when you're talking about health, and you're talking about budgets and stuff, then sorting out the nutrition is probably one of the better places to put your money, because actually, if you start supplying people with food that is good for them, it's going to cost you a lot less than a lot of the stuff that's currently fed to them that isn't good for them.
I mean, absolutely. And, you know, I'm sort of a very much a convert to this. I think the time I spent working with Debbie when she was here doing her naturopath stuff and hosting her shows, there was certainly an osmosis there. She never quite nagged me enough to give up the cigarettes. And I used to get it in the neck as well for the coffee and a few other things. But there was a certain wisdom that came in with that. And, I mean, I found over time, just whilst being here, is we've started eating cleaner and cleaner food. We now get a bit bothered. If we've had a very busy day, the age-old temptation was to call up for a Chinese and get something in. It's now almost a case of a slightly daunting task. It's a case of, is my stomach going to pay for it the next day? Because we're eating not necessarily perfectly healthy. Certainly, we could probably cut back on the meat a bit more and look at a closer sourcing on certain things a bit more. But we're trying to get cleaner, organic, better than what we can, or looking for the quality of food. And it's certainly changed the way our health worked. But also, to me, it's a slow progression. You know, I think it'd be very hard for someone to come from your McDonald's diet to suddenly turn around the next day and turn raw vegan.
Yeah.
I think you've got to give your body, I mean, I wouldn't want to think, you know, I think you've really got to look at how you transition through it. and how you can clean up little bits at a time and maybe certain detoxes, and how you can actually have a slow approach to it, which I think in a way is more likely to take.
Yes, to me it seemed to happen pretty naturally, because I've moved more or less from a completely unhealthy pastry, chip, Ginsters and Coca-Cola based diet to something that's more or less entirely vegetables and water. And and things have just gone. It's like I used to drink gallons of instant coffee, and at some point I just stopped drinking instant coffee. If I have coffee now, it will only be real, and I won't have too much of it in a day. And it's a bit funny. It is a bit like there's a kind of inner me sort of deciding deciding just for itself that it doesn't want stuff anymore. Another thing that struck me the other day is I suddenly, at some stage about 8 years ago, I stopped wearing sunglasses. I always really liked wearing sunglasses, part of the image, you know. And it's only whilst I've been kind of looking into the pineal and the importance of sun gazing and all that kind of stuff that you realise that the sunglasses probably weren't helping. I made no decision on that, just like I made no decision about becoming basically somebody who eats fish and veg rather than somebody who eats meat. I just woke up one morning and didn't want meat anymore. And that's a really great way of making changes when you don't even intend to, and when things that are basically clearly advantageous just kind of arise and are taken on board. It's the way I'd really like to see change being made. I'd like to see people just waking up and not wanting to do what they've been doing.
Yes. Yes, sorry, I was a bit distracted there. The chat took off a moment there. I don't know if you saw the questions.
I'm just looking at one from Vin.
An extent, I'm assuming that Vin was picking up on some of the stuff from earlier.
Yeah.
And, I think it was only a case of hanging around free festivals at a young age or something, and different things. I sort of never got round to voting when I was a youngster. Even having had a moment where I was sort of involved with certain political people, it just never came up. And I have, as of the course of my life, never actually voted in terms of a government thing. And I think in total I possibly voted only a couple of times, I recall, in union things.
Yeah.
And I think I sort of hit on it a long time ago. I think it was, again, it was one of the grey-haired wise men who'd probably just wandered off a beaten-up old coach, and I think just the comment was, it's a case of, well, it doesn't change anything. Why do you think it's worth anything? And I sort of saw a logic behind that at the outset. And I think, I mean, in theory, it's a case of, do you think that your vote gives power to a government to force a set of circumstances? To an extent, it's a case of, I would say the analogy is, at the moment, my name is not on a list as registered. And it was something I picked up, I think, in that pod of saying, well, if you're registered to vote and you have cast your vote and the majority has spoken, it's a case of, all right, but there's a very much an exclusion in terms of the registering. And, you know, even before that was considered, I'd sort of dropped off a good half dozen years ago because I didn't see a purpose to it.
No.
You know, to that extent, you know, and I've had this thing, I've had Facebook discussions. If I actually say that to people, I don't vote, like, I do get some very upset people.
Yeah, it's almost as unpopular as not paying taxes.
Oh, it's worse.
Do you think so?
Yes, I've seen some very irate people over it. And it took me a while to consider the logic of how I might respond to them. And quite often I just sort of leave it or keep out of it or stay out of the politics.
Yeah.
Which is usually my preferred option anyway, is just not to get there in the first place.
Yeah.
But I almost got the feeling, I think I put this analogy out a couple of weeks ago in the discussion. It's almost a case of, I'm stood outside opposite the casino. You've gone into that casino and you've bet all your money on black and it's come up red. And you're now coming out of that casino with empty pockets and you're blaming it on me.
Yeah.
Now, meantime, there's probably a guy in there who's having a wonderful time who bet on the right people, but...
I bloody doubt it.
All right, but then, ultimately, if anyone's aware of how a casino works, who ultimately wins all the time? It's the house.
Yeah. So Vin's question is, do you have the power? Can you transfer it? And I'd basically assume that being as that there's one above and none below, you don't have the power. and you can't transfer it, therefore.
Yeah.
So I'd say no.
I mean, there is the technical point of saying the Queen is swearing an oath to act on behalf of the people.
She might have sworn an oath to do that.
Yeah. And, I mean, in a sense, it's a case of, in theory, we are individually sovereign. But quite a way back in history, before we were even around, certain people have got in and they're taking care of that sovereignty for us. And they don't seem inclined to give it back.
No.
And it would seem that if we were to, I mean, to an extent of something we saw in the 80s, of if there are signs of it being taken back, there can be very bad reactions and confrontations.
Yeah, I think the idea can be extended a little to that pod we were playing earlier as well, because one of the questions he was asking was, you know, is it ever moral to force complete strangers to give you money? You know, is it moral for me to do that? No, it isn't. So the government, being a bunch of men and women, is it moral for them to do it? And the answer is it isn't. But the thing is, that's certainly something that I don't have the power to do. I do not have the power myself to walk up to other people and force them under threats of force and coercion to give me money. And therefore, even if we do vote for the government on the majority basis that the lawyer was suggesting, on that particular question, it doesn't matter whether we voted for them or not, because we definitely don't have the power to do that, and so we definitely don't have the power to grant to somebody else, and they certainly, therefore, can't in any way exercise it, really, I would have assumed, even under the matter of consent, because it's not something that even in our most careless moments we actually have the power to consent to. It is funny, it was something I was thinking about whilst I was listening to it.
Mm. I mean, I have seen this, I've had personal experience of this, of asking the questions of certain authorities, and you raise the question about consent, and it gets very quickly glossed over, because the people you're generally dealing with don't really know how to answer it, so they just have ways to sidestep.
Mm.
I don't think it's a case of, in general, the people you deal with don't have the depth of background legally to put forth a cogent response. They only have ways to avoid the question. And you don't get access to the people in the know. To an extent, I find that pod riveting. It's a case of, we seem to have lured someone out who's expressing certain things. You may be able to draw conclusions from them and look out deeper. And I think certainly Mark played it quite well to keep the discussion going. I would love to be, in a sense, a fly on the wall of that guy after that interview.
Yes, I'm sure it's going to be very interesting for him to listen back on it and hear what he had to say.
I think you sort of hold out hope of, did something Mark say perhaps give him cause to look at things a bit deeper?
I think it's so much in the mindset of the lawyer that it's not even a question that needs to arise.
Yeah.
Which is more or less what he said again and again at the beginning of the pod, was, he was just completely puzzled by the fact that anybody should want to do that. But then, given as he and all his buddies and all his training and everything are there entirely to support that idea, I guess we shouldn't be surprised that that's the way it turned out.
I mean, I sort of vaguely, it's been a long time since I've watched Mark Stevens, and I have a vague memory of how Mark would work, and I could see he was saying almost at the outset of a court case, you'd be challenging the jurisdiction. And he did move on into the second part, that even if that was overlooked, and I think I remember he said there are specific set sequence of questions he used to use in a very fixed method to actually try and address the question of jurisdiction, but could deal with even avoidance of them. And I think he was making the point is that later on, where they bring in their officers or their expert witnesses, that you can actually, I think he was saying, you can call into question their ability to make a legal determination.
Well, we know that we can do that because they don't have first-hand knowledge, do they?
Yeah. But to some extent, it's certainly something I've subscribed again to Mark. I don't know quite why I dropped out of watching his YouTubes. I think it was more a case of just looking to other topics.
Yeah, I just haven't... I've heard his name before. I hadn't watched him before. It's just that by some quirk of fate, that particular link came my way, and it just happened to be quite suitable, I thought, for tonight's show. And he came up with some very interesting statements, the lawyer, which would stray away, I'm sure, if he was a live guest on the show, have come up with a load of very interesting questions from the chat box. So one of the ones that struck me towards the end was that he said, well, you know, strictly speaking, the taxing authority is not absolute other. It's not a foreign entity, he said. It's me, it's my family, it's my community. Do you think he actually believes that?
I think it's almost a case of that's what you have to cling to. Because if you give ground, there's certain things you can't give ground on, because then your logic crumbles.
Mm.
And I think, you know, sometimes I think this is where you might see a reasoned discussion turn a bit emotional.
Mm.
I mean, I think there were quite a few things that didn't get touched on. I noticed one of the phrases I called into question a long time ago, and it never quite came out. They got halfway, was no taxation without representation.
Yes, which he actually mentioned, didn't he?
They got halfway through, and I think it was the lawyer who was going to do it, but he sort of changed topic.
Yeah.
Because my thing on that is to challenge it. It's a case of, I think it was only just playing with the concept that I started turning it around in my head one day, and I thought, well, hang on. Generally, I think, and probably this goes back to, say, school history lessons or something off the TV or some sort of received wisdom, is that was the slogan that was used, and it all turned out okay because they gave these guys the vote. And it's only recently starting to look at things linguistically in different ways, and I thought, I see two choices there. Because I think, you know, they're saying there's an either-or, there's a conditional situation there. They're saying no taxation without representation. In this case, could there not have been the alternative solution of no taxation?
Yes. And also, you could come up more correctly with the statement, it's all okay because we took their vote off them, which is what registration is.
Yeah, to an extent.
Yeah.
But it would almost seem, I think, once you almost flip the story around, it's a case of, well, I think if you'd weighed up the two options, it's a case of, would you rather have no taxation or would you rather have this vote? I think they got the lesser of the deal. And at a time in terms of...
They got taxation and no representation. That's what they got.
Well, it's a case of, we're not going to... it's a case of, we won't take away the taxation, but we'll give you this vote.
Yes.
You know, have a shiny thing.
But again, that's smoke and mirrors, isn't it? Because while saying that, they were actually palming your vote.
Yeah, to an extent. There was a lot of playing around with that terms. But, I mean, also, it turns back on itself now. And I think if you turn the phrase again, it's a case of, all right, no taxation without representation. And you look at the situation now of, in terms of who's in power, who are they representing? Who calls the shots for their decisions? It's not the mass of the people paying the taxes. There's the powerful interests who don't pay taxes.
That's it. And anyway, the taxes, the people say, do not go to empty their bins and build their roads and find their lost dogs and keep their libraries open and all that sort of stuff. They just go to pay a debt.
Yes. And I think in some ways, if people actually pulled it back, you know, I think, you know, there was one thing on here, it's a case of 15 people vote, so we all pay tax.
Yeah.
I'm going to propose something alternative, maybe something a little bit more sovereign. They have a vote. 15 people vote to pay tax, and because they voted and they're people of their word, they pay their tax. The 5 people who didn't vote are under no obligation to pay tax. And I think you take the force element out of it. But the other 15 people say, maybe rather than trying to insist you pay the same amount as us, it's a case of, could you guys bring in a half share? Counter-offer.
Yeah.
You negotiate, or you come back next year, it's a case of, we'd like to do some extra things. We'd like you to bung in this amount, or could you offer something to us? If it becomes a voluntary thing, I think you can sort of put it to human nature.
And what about some demonstration that what you believe the taxes are being spent on is actually what they're being spent on? You know, perhaps, I, you know, hesitate to suggest it, but a degree of direct accountability between what they're receiving and what they're spending it on, and not losing $9 trillion off your defence budget, for example.
I mean, there's certainly things in terms of, I mean, the big issue now is if we are going to be part of a whole continent. as we seem to have become, or are we going to break away? And not that I'm in the habit of expressing too much of opinion one way or another of these things, but it's a case of the general thing that concerns me is a case of the bigger parliament in Europe can't audit its accounts.
Nope.
Yeah, regardless of any sort of governmental issues or constitutional issues, it's a case of, do you want to do business with people who can't actually produce a set of books ever?
Not been signed off for over 10 years now.
Yeah.
And they have their own anti-fraud department called OLAF, which sounds extremely endearing, but anybody who tries blowing a whistle in there gets fairly quickly set fire to and thrown out with the trash.
Yeah. I mean, all we seem to have done, and, you know, this, I was a small child in the days of Ted Heath and that referendum thing. It's a very vague childhood memory. It certainly wasn't what was being talked about back then. It's certainly not what's being talked about back now.
No.
Whatever it is, it hasn't benefited us. You know, even for, like, the ordinary guy who might want to just pop over the channel and get some cheap wine and his fags, even on that mundane level, they can't facilitate that. You know, if the ordinary guy has got a better break on it.
People who continue trading as commercial entities without supplying books and proof of payment and all that kind of stuff are generally shut down pretty quickly. And one of the things I'd really like to see is at least a kind of equilibrium of application of the rules. I mean, that was another thing that our man said. Where was he? He said that we... the jurisdiction, the state will apply its laws within its jurisdiction, and everyone enjoys the benefits of those laws equally. Yeah, well, that was
no.
Pick the bones out of that.
Well, hang on. We have people who can go extrajudicial. We have the likes of corporations who are offshoring their intellectual property.
We do.
You know, they can sit in a meeting room in one part of the world and actually have just an idea. And that idea suddenly gets shipped off to a tax haven. And then it's licensed back to the rest of the company at a fee. So we're paying, it's a completely above board fee. It's a transaction within the business, but it lands in this other place.
Yeah.
And we do have to look. I'm not one to be putting labels on who's to blame or things, but we do have to look in terms of the history of this island has very much put a lot of this in place.
Yeah.
In terms of we are one of the people who could make a major difference in terms of how tax havens, because we got so many.
Yeah.
We can deal with that.
And royal cousins share the rest amongst them, I suspect.
Yes. And, you know, it's a matter of we're actually hearing things now that, you know, so many people are involved in these different things. You know, I think looking through history, there's always people with connections who seem to shuffle the money about.
Mm.
And now it does tie it up and away from the people.
And now we've got these massive, massive stacks of what they're calling limited liability companies that are all operating under fronts which make them completely undetectable for any kind of charging purpose, what or whichsoever. Then there's also this bizarre idea he had of the idea that if enough people wanted to, they could... They could amend the Constitution to abolish taxation. Like, there isn't any law saying that people have got to pay tax anyway, so they don't need to amend the Constitution. But even if that theoretical right exists, I think they'd have a hell of a job doing it. And the most important point about that is he then drew the conclusion that because there is this collective power to change the rules, and the rules are not being changed, then that is the same thing as collective responsibility for the rules. Do you think that's fair?
No.
No.
No, but I wouldn't know how to actually explain it back to someone coming from that point of view. You know, I think... I'd have got halfway through that, and, you know, it's kind of, look, I'm out here.
Yeah.
You know, I can try and put this so many different ways. I know you're not getting this, and I don't quite know exactly how I can rephrase this or change it to sort of get that sort of common ground. And, you know, even, I think, small things of hope, I don't really particularly think that one or two good guys in positions of power can turn this round.
No.
And that's all. That's the only thing that seems to be on offer, and I suspect there's other things at play there.
And it applies a little bit more generally than that, doesn't it? And as far as the whole system seems to be implying that if we continue to vote and continue to get different people in and continue to tinker with the layout on the control board or the colours of the bells and or the sounds of the bells or the colours of the whistles or whatever it is, that eventually we will make a system which blatantly is highly destructive of almost everything and make it work fine and tickety-boo. And that fundamentally is the basis of the election system, isn't it? Is, oh, let's try again, shall we?
Well, yeah, it is. It's that, why keep repeating the same mistake? And, yeah, we almost seem to have got to that point of, I've heard people make the point of, have we tried every single political ethos going? I think all of them had their own sort of go. Maybe she had the analysis and realised that none of it's working and try and find something that works rather than tying it all together in one direction or another that you seem to think was the best of the worst. No one's gaining from this. Even if the corporations win short term, when there's nothing left for them, we've all lost.
Yes. Yeah, because what we're seeing is fundamentally destructive interaction and rapine and robbery. You know, what we are seeing is what was described in that earlier podcast as a group of men and women forcing another bunch of men and women to give them money or threatening to lock them up. Or saying, even more impractically, or you can leave. you can nip over the border next door and find yourself in the same or similar situation, but just with somebody else. Mm-hmm. Again, no solution. The thing is that there is now nowhere for us to leave to. And the option to leave, I think, should be expressed in exactly the kind of the sort of things we talk about here, that you know, we shouldn't be obliged to give money. In fact, we're not. In fact, it is a criminal offence for us to give money to people who will then take that money and use it to cause harm, loss and damage to others.
There have been situations, I know I've spoken to people who are connected with Quakers, and they say there are Quakers who withhold. They don't withhold all their tax. They say, we are withholding a certain amount in respect of your defence spending.
Yeah.
There are certain ways and means you can make a difference. I mean, generally, I mean, I have to say, in a sense, this is almost becoming a situation. We have so many people who are literally so running out of money, they can't pay the taxes anyway.
No, well, of course not. No, and in fact, so many people, you know, everybody who buys anything has to pay the VAT. Anybody who's working on PAYEs like to have income tax and national insurance and God knows what else taken off them, as it were. But
All right, but now we get to the crazy situation is that you work and you get your payslip and you have all this tax, national insurance things. They come out, but then you have to have the government come in and give you some tax credits to throw in, which really is your employer's subsidy to keep the wages low.
Yep, the idea being that the government then pursues the employer and takes the tax off them, but I gather that very rarely happens.
But then you get the situation of those sort of people, they're the ones who are fed this information. It's a case of, well, your pay packet is rubbish because of those poor people over there. You know, if we didn't have to look after them, you could possibly do better. And so, there are still people who call for that.
Yeah.
And I have to look in terms of what I've seen, and this is only locally. You know, and it's doing a little bit of your digging of pulling up the local paper and sitting through the court reports of seeing people who are no fixed address, picked up in the city centre, and it's either, I mean, it used to be the Section 5, now it's this new public spaces order stuff going on. It's you're no fixed address, you happen to be in the part of town where it's not acceptable for you to be visible to the ordinary and upright people. So we've hauled you into court. You're going to get this fine, which is fixed, and we can't do anything about that. And then you're going to pay a victim surcharge to whom we do not know. Because, again, you know, this is the thing. You put in the Constitution, right, taxes are illegal. It's a case of, will have a service charge. We'll call it something else.
Yeah.
But, you know, this is a case of these are people, as far as I can see, living on the streets, having their stuff stolen when they've got so little to go with anyway, hauled into court and fined that they can't pay with anyway because they're on the streets, hit with an additional tax for daring to take up court time through not really actions of their own doing and being put in a situation where they should be being looked after and supported and have a roof over their head in this climate. You know, just a basic human decency, you shouldn't be having people out on freezing cold nights.
No, and any expense involved in doing that should not ideally be regarded as an unnecessary and unwarranted expense by the rest of a population.
Absolutely. I saw one, it was a way back last year, they said, ironically, I think it was the state of Utah in the States, actually sat down and looked at their books, and they realised it actually worked out cheaper in the long run to go out to the homeless people, find them, pick them up and stick them in a house.
Yeah.
And actually sort their problem out and get them off the streets and give them a bit of assistance and get them back on their feet.
And only a tiny, tiny, tiny amount of resource would be necessary to do that relative to the resource that's being utilised by the state for doing loads of things that we might not necessarily want to support.
Yes. I think by the same token, you sort of see... I see a ray of hope in terms of what the Swiss people have done in terms of basic income. That has come out of nowhere as part of a narrative of saying stop all this stupid administrative cost and just give people a basic amount of money.
Yeah, save yourself loads of money. Save yourself loads of cash in the process.
And I know the logic that comes in this country is a case of, well, if you give people money, they'll get lazy. And I think... I will concede there are certain people who think, well, yeah, if I can scrape by on this, I can just sit down and not do anything.
My argument as somebody working in industry with hundreds of agency people working for me over the years was that such people, it's more effective for us to pay them to keep them out of the rest of our way. And also, there could easily be a context. All of those people have got something to offer. It's just that what we've got at the moment is a society which is one size fits none. Loads of people get marginalised, who could otherwise be made useful. I believe. I mean, we're coming now. We're only 7 minutes or so away from the end of the show, so we've got 3 or 4 minutes. I just want to mention that Freeman Jack's coming up at 11 o'clock. He's doing a replay of his Googleplex show, The First Synthetic Mind. That will be replaying from 11 o'clock. I'm looking forward to hearing that again myself. It was really great. But he says we can have a bit of extra time if we would like to. How would you like to sum up? Where do you think we need to go?
I think we just need to keep looking at the options. Keep looking at everything. Don't be ruling stuff out. Keep seeking solutions as work so far. I see no reason to change that as a way of going.
No, we are making progress, are we not, in so many ways?
Yeah. And I think in some ways part of what we do as well, learning how to be better in ourselves as hosts. As hosts, we are learning to speak. You know, I'm finding my voice through shows like this. How much useful that can be in the wider thing, I do not know. But it's to be able to speak for yourself and reason and to share that with people and get people addressing these situations and thinking about them.
And to keep things peaceful under all circumstances, I'd say. It's not just a matter of being peaceful when you're facing the man in the fancy dress. I regard one of my basic missions in life, where things are getting so disturbed and disturbing, and where people can so easily get so excited, where they can take things personally, where they can take their own emotional problems, project them on somebody else, and that under all those circumstances, having an individual who understands a little bit more about what's going on and continues to ask questions and keep things calm is doing just a little bit to keep things manageable.
Absolutely. We've got to learn to all take it easy and abide a bit more as dudes.
Yeah.
And I need other people to do that because I try my best to do it. And I think like everyone else, we're human here. And although we may do our best, we can all lose it from time to time. And having a few people at your shoulder, just a hand on the shoulder, it's like, come on, back down from it.
Yeah.
You know, as long as we don't lose it en masse, as long as there's someone always there doing some calmness and trying to set some logic and reason around it, we're in with a chance.
Yeah, I quite agree. I think that's well said indeed, Nick. So thanks very much for coming on and spending a couple of hours with me. We can do it again sometime.
I want to do it again soon. I feel like I only just got warmed up. It was a blast.
Very good. Well, there's always space for you on the show, chap. And, okay. And we'll continue.
I have to drag you out on an early evening sometime. You can come round my place.
Oh, that'd be great. I'd love to, yeah. I'll come round and sit in the passenger seat and eat your Danish pastries.
I want to have a talk, because I noticed we have Jimmy in there. I've been putting some feelers out. I want some guys to come together to talk about the open source side of things.
Great.
Well, so I want to keep that one up in the air. Not necessarily to do loads of stuff, but to get some of the key things out there and try and get a bit more interest going.
Yeah, good move. I'm up for that as well. So we've made it to the end of another one, mate. Thanks a lot, Nick. Nick Nomick, for joining me. It's been really brilliant to have our first on-air chat, and I look forward to more of it in the future. I'm sure you'll be back 6 to 8 next week.
I'm enjoying it at the moment.
Brilliant.
Best gig on the radio.
Excellent.
I wouldn't want to be anywhere else.
I couldn't wish for anybody better. Warm in the chat room up for me. So we're going to go a few seconds over. We are, but I know that Big Jack won't mind. And being as we know Freeman Jack's coming up at 11 o'clock, I'm going to play out with Big D and the kids' table, and the surgery will get in an early noise complaint. Yeah, indeed. So thanks to Nick, thanks to PIR, thanks to the Kitchen Posse, thanks to all the people in the chat box. And sorry I haven't paid too much attention to what's going on in there, because I've been listening to Nick. Here comes up Big D and the kids' table, and I'll be back with you next week. Jack, you've got about 3 minutes, mate. Like I say, Freeman Jack, don't touch that dial. Cheers, folks.
You're listening to www.peoplesinternetradio.com, seeking solutions.